Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of the Liberty Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Patrick McFarlane. This one is episode 174, and the show notes may be found at libertyweekly.net/174. Before we begin, I just wanted to take a second and thank everyone who came over from Free Man Beyond the Wall, Mance Rayder's podcast. I did an interview with Mance Rayder about my Uyghur genocide documentary, and it got a lot of attention, and there's a lot of new listeners headed this way. I really do appreciate it. I hope you take the time to explore all of the back catalog of the Liberty Weekly podcast. I've been at this for almost as long as Pete has been doing that. I actually know him as Mance. But so anyway, we're both colleagues at the Libertarian Institute. You can find my work at libertarianinstitute.org/Patrick. So today I have another deep dive. It's not going to be a feature documentary like my Uyghur genocide allegations documentary. However, what I really want to do with Liberty Weekly is to do more deep dive, well-researched content and not just interviews. I'll do interviews as well, but not as much as what I want to focus on, which is these deep dive kind of documentaries style, Corbett Report style episodes where I really dive deep into a topic, because I think that the Liberty Sphere needs more of that kind of content. So today I'm going to be talking about the presidential assassination that took place in Haiti and the rumors and kind of the interventionists across the United States and across the world who are pushing for the United States and the UN and the OAS to intervene in Haiti. And the OAS stands for the Organization of American States, which is the conglomeration of states that have intervened in Haiti for the past 10, 15, 20 or so years. So this one, tentatively, I'm going to title it The U.S. Must Cease Intervening in Haiti. And I penned an op-ed that will be appearing at the Libertarian Institute. However, I have published here on my website at libertyweekly.net. It will serve as a transcript for this episode. So there will be a mid-roll. I'm not going to make any announcements here aside from this brief introduction, but let's get into it. So The U.S. Must Cease Intervening in Haiti by Patrick McFarlane. And this is a topic that's near and dear to me because I'm going to dedicate this episode to my in-laws, my brothers and sisters, my wife's brothers and sisters. There are adopted children in her family that are from Haiti, and this is dedicated to them. So to start off here, President Jovenel Moise was assassinated during the early morning hours of Wednesday, July 7th, 2021. He was assassinated in his home by a team of gunmen, and his first lady, Martine Moise, was critically injured. She was airlifted to Florida, to Miami, Florida, for treatment, where she remains in critical condition. So my first source for this story was Sputnik, which is interesting because Sputnik is a Russian outlet. However, it details how martial law was declared in Haiti after the president's assassination. So those details, at about 1 a.m. overnight into Wednesday, a group of unknown individuals, some of whom spoke Spanish, attacked the president's private residence and lethally wounded the head of state, Claude Joseph said in a statement. Now, this might get a little redundant with the transcript for this episode, but Claude Joseph is the interim prime minister. He was appointed to be prime minister after his predecessor either stepped down or was disqualified in some way. But he has been serving, I think, since the beginning of this year. So here on the screen, we can see the official statement of the Republic of Haiti communication. It's in French, and I don't speak French. However, this is the official communication. So in the way of a little background, President Moise was elected the president of Haiti on February 7th, 2017. According to Moise's opposition, however, his four-year term was to end on February 7th, 2021, and Moise refused to step down on that date. He argued that the Haitian constitution entitled him to a five-year term. From what I can tell, it's his argument is centered around the fact that he actually took office later than he should have. And that's kind of the crux of his argument. However, the Haitian constitution and Haitian law, from what I've been able to tell throughout this whole process, is just kind of haphazard. So that's kind of emblematic of Haiti as a country and their political situation. So Moise has since remained in office, spurring months of opposition protests and rising crime rates that some outlets blame on Moise himself. Now, we're going to get into this a bit, but there's indication. Well, it's actually kind of proven, and I attempt to prove it in this article, but that Moise himself was put into power directly through the lineage of the United States influence on Haiti itself. So to support the assertion that I make that President Moise is allegedly involved in the violence that was sweeping through Haiti in the last few weeks, I cite this article from, I don't know how to pronounce this, but Violent Rule by Decree, for those of you that are listening just on the audio version. The violence that in the end consumed the president's life was not random. It was planned, supported, and orchestrated by a cluster of actors, including President Moise himself. He strengthened his grip on authoritarian rule to stamp out the popular revolt that began exactly 3 years ago when his government announced a 36% hike in gas prices called for by the International Monetary Fund. So we see the specter of foreign involvement here as well. So on July 6, 2018, people took to the streets in the first Pays Loc lockdown. I think that must be Creole. Or a general strike. Not only did the Haitian government back down, but the first of Moise's prime ministers fell on the sword, resigning as a result. So a month later, the revolt took direction from the still unanswered question posed on Twitter, where are the funds from Petro Caribe? The government had little to show for billions of dollars earmarked for development. This historic movement and cross-class alliance succeeded in forcing the appeals court to investigate state corruption, issuing a report at the end of May 2019 that implicated Moise, as well as his predecessor, Michel Martelly, and Martelly's prime minister, Laurent Lamont, in the misuse or disappearance of over $2 billion in Petro-Caribe funds. And as the movement gained steam, Moise increasingly turned to authoritarianism and street violence. An early sign was the November 2018 massacre in the La Saline neighborhood, a stronghold of resistance to Moise and his ruling party. On January 13, 2020, Moise seized the opportunity provided by the expiration of parliament's terms, ironically the day after the 10-year anniversary of the deadly earthquake, to begin ruling by decree. So that's when he kind of overstayed his term. So these news outlets are linked in the show notes page where I have the kind of the rough transcript of my article for this episode. But you can see this is the outlet that's reporting it. It's NACLA. I'm not too familiar with this outlet. However, if you go to their about page, they say they're an independent nonprofit organization founded in 1966, working toward a world in which the nations and peoples of Latin America and the Caribbean are free from oppression and injustice and enjoy a relationship with the United States based on mutual respect, free from economic and political subordination. So it looks like they're kind of advocating for non-interventionism. So the aftermath of the assassination was actually filmed by the late president's neighbors. And this filming, the Miami Herald was one of the first outlets to pick up on the story. And according to the Miami Herald, a man can be heard in one of the videos yelling in English over a megaphone saying, DEA operation, everybody stand down. DEA operation, everybody back up and stand down. Now, of course, DEA stands for Department of Drug or... Oh my God. DEA stands for United States Drug Enforcement Administration. I actually had to look that one up here very quickly. So you can see, I'll play just a snippet of the video here. So for those of you watching, you can see a dark street and there's men standing around with guns. One of them gets out of a truck and he's kind of running across the road.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can hear them speaking what sounds like Spanish to each other. And so that's about what we got from the first reports here. So Bokit Edmond, and I'm probably butchering his name, the Haitian ambassador to the United States, stated that the attack, quote, was carried out by foreign mercenaries and professional killers, that it was well orchestrated, and that the attackers were, quote, masquerading as agents of the DEA. He asked the U.S. government for assistance with the investigation. And this is something that we're going to be seeing throughout kind of this episode in this documentary, is the theme of Haitian officials asking the United States for intervention, as if it's some kind of carte blanche excuse for the West to become involved, because somehow these Haitian officials have the consent of everyone in Haiti, and somehow these Haitian officials, who are known to be corrupt, actually have the ability to call in foreign actors to intervene and occupy the country forcibly. And somehow that makes it okay. So Haitian officials claim at least 28 people were involved in the assassination plot, including 26 Colombian citizens and 2 Haitian Americans. On July 8th, Haitian National Police Chief Leon Charles confirmed that 15 Colombians and the 2 Haitian Americans that had been taken into custody. 3 others were killed in a firefight with authorities. The 2 Haitian Americans were identified as 35-year-old James Soliges and 55-year-old Joseph Vincent. Soliges has been circumstantially linked to Haitian oligarchs Reginald Boulos and Dimitri Vorbe. Although Boulos and Vorbe were initially friendly to Moise, they later became his outspoken critics, leading many Haitians to believe that they are involved themselves with the killing. So here on screen, we're taking a look with the report from Mint Press News. Dan Cohen of Behind the Headlines penned this article linking this Joseph Soliges and members of the assassination team to the United States. And this is circumstantial evidence. He's very clear on that. But the headline is, suspected assassins of Haitian President Moise trained by U.S. linked to pro-coup oligarchy. And it says the subtitle is, as the investigation into Moise's murder unfolds, the U.S. is laying the groundwork to deploy troops into Haiti for the fourth time in 106 years at the request of a figure it has spent decades grooming. And that is Claude Joseph. So we go through here just a little bit, and I kind of get into this later in the article, but essentially the meat and potatoes of what I've already said is in this article here. So talking about Soliges being hired previously, working as a security guard at the Canadian embassy in Haiti. This is confirmed by the Canadian embassy. He apparently, Soliges, was an avid and vocal supporter of President Michel Martelly, who was directly installed by Hillary Clinton. We'll find out later in this episode. He was also involved, the founder of Moise's Haitian Bald-Headed Party, according to Tony Jean Thenor, a leader of the VAYO popular organization in Miami. Some links here. The Haitian Times reported Soliges used to work as a security guard for Reginald Boulos and Dimitri Vorbe, 2 prominent members of Haiti's tiny bourgeois. Although initially friendly to him, they both became bitter opponents of Moise. Boulos was a prominent supporter of previous coups in 1991 and 2004 against President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Now, the Boulos family is one of the wealthiest families in Haiti. They own a pharmaceutical company that in 1996 was responsible for poisoning scores of children with its tainted fever medicine, and some fatally. Since I'm reading here from the Mint Press News for those of you who are not watching. But since the July 6th to 8th, 2018 national uprising against the IMF-dictated hike of fuel prices, Boulos has attempted to recast himself as a popular and progressive figure after one of his stores was burned and looted, heading a political party called the Third Way Movement. So now Vorbe is the executive director and vice president of Societe Generale d'Energie SA, one of the largest private energy companies in Haiti, which had a sweetheart deal involving power to the energy grid that Moise sought to renegotiate after the collapse of the Petro Caribe program, which under Venezuela, under which, Venezuela provided Haiti with cheap oil and credit from 2008 to 2018. Many believe that Bulos is the intellectual author and financial backer of Moise's murder. This is a quote from Kim Ives. He is the English newspaper editor of Haiti Liberté. That's a print publication in Haiti, a print and web publication. He says a lot of factors have been pointing to his involvement, that is Bulos. The arrival of the mercenaries in 9 brand new Nissan patrol vehicles without license plates suggests that they were vehicles coming from the Nissan dealership owned by Reginald Bulos. The Haitian people have already concluded that Bulos was behind the assassination and have uprooted the dealership, Auto Mecca, that he owned. So interesting that people in Haiti are taking things into their own hands. I think it also portends that any kind of foreign intervention might be met with force, which is something that we'll explore just a little bit later. So another thing that was a little suspicious, headed back to my article, is that the day before the assassination of President Moise, President Moise nominated Ariel Henry, a neurosurgeon, to replace Claude Joseph as prime minister. Ariel Henry was slated to be sworn in to the position on the afternoon of Wednesday, July 7th. That's the same day that the assassination took place early in the morning. So on Tuesday, we have the nomination of Ariel Henry. On Wednesday morning at 1 in the morning, this team comes in and assassinates Moise. And then later that afternoon on Wednesday, Henry was supposed to be installed and sworn in as the new prime minister, which would put him, you know, second in command through the power succession. So following the assassination, Moise's interim prime minister, Claude Joseph, assumed a tenuous control of the Haitian government. And as of the writing of this article and the recording of this episode, Joseph remains in power, though questions persist regarding the proper succession of presidential authority. Because, I mean, what happens when Ariel Henry has been nominated and is scheduled to be sworn in? However, the assassination happens in the meantime. The timing of it, whoever, we know that somebody plotted this coup, the timing of it is just, you know, perfect. It's perfect timing. So Joseph declared a state of martial law immediately following news of the assassination. Fearing unrest, the Dominican Republic also closed its border with Haiti, which if you know Haiti, Haiti is an island nation. However, the island is split in half, and one side is Haiti and the other side is the Dominican Republic. And also the Port-au-Prince International Airport in the Haiti's capital city was shuttered, and all the arriving planes were rerouted. So despite Joseph's declaration of martial law, the political situation appears relatively stable. It's not pandemonium. There have been some reports of looting and rioting. We just saw a report that the auto dealership owned by Bulos was raided and looted. That's because, you know, vigilantism, people in Haiti think that he's behind this coup attempt. And even though they didn't like Moise, what they like least of all is someone meddling in the presidential politics and affairs without any kind of, you know, democratic consensus, which we don't really believe in on this show. However, other people do. So, despite Joseph's declaration of martial law, things seem relatively stable. Nonetheless, the assassination has the potential to exacerbate an already turbulent political state of affairs, one to which the United States and other international influences are not innocent third parties. So we already kind of went over the political situation that was taking place before Moise was assassinated. We see, you know, unrest. We see the petroleum or the gas prices hiking in 2018, but we also see a lot of massacres and street violence that's taking place, and protests in opposition to the president as well. Well, now we have the history of the United States influence on Haiti. And this is only the recent history since the earthquake. So the U.S. and the OAS, Organization of American States, have controlled the Haitian presidency since at least 2011. If the current Haitian political arrangement appears chaotic, the U.S. and the U.S.-led Organization of American States own a lion's share of the blame. So I'm reading here from an article posted in Common Dreams. And this is an insider, Ricardo Seitenfuss. He is a law professor, if you go all the way down to his bio. He's a professor at the law school at the Federal University of Santa Maria, Brazil. He was also the OAS special representative to Haiti from 2009 to 2011. So he is involved in the OAS, and he penned this article in Common Dreams here. So here's the excerpt. He was there for a lot of this. He was present. So he writes, in April 2009, the U.S. State Department, under the leadership of Hillary Clinton, decided to completely change the nature of the U.S. cooperation with Haiti. Apparently, tired with the lack of concrete results of U.S. aid, Hillary decided to align the policies of the State Department with the, quote, smart power doctrine proposed by the Clinton Foundation. From that moment on, following trends in philanthropy, the solutions of U.S. assistance would be based solely on, quote, evidence. The idea, according to Cheryl Mills, Clinton's chief of staff, quote, was that if we're putting in the assistance, we need to know what the outcomes are going to be, end quote. The January 2010 earthquake was the long-awaited opportunity to test this new policy. The idea was to transform Haiti into a Taiwan of the Caribbean with maquiladoras, which is it's a type of duty-free factory where they take raw materials and produce goods, in apparel industry, tourism, and call centers. So interesting, you're going to take all of these people of Haiti who have lived in destitute poverty for such a long time and give them jobs, factory jobs, tourism jobs, and jobs in a call center. So these, I don't know about food production or basic infrastructure seems like it would be first on the list. However, these would be the niche sectors that would guide the new cooperation framework. In this plan, the particularities of Haiti itself didn't matter much. So that is the special envoy from the Organization of American States writing. So to set this plan in motion, Clinton selected Cheryl Mills, who I mentioned before in this excerpt, to head the U.S. State Department's Haiti task force, despite the fact that Mills had neither training nor experience in international development. However, Cheryl Mills was one of Bill Clinton's attorneys during his impeachment trial, so she has that feather in her cap. She's also a longtime attorney for the Clinton family. So in order for the Haitian people to accept Clinton and Mills' technocratic agenda, and that's what it was, it had to be window dressed, the agenda did, had to be window dressed as democratic consensus in Haiti. This first required the breaking of the country's deadlocked presidential race, which had been pushed from April 28, 2010 to November 28, 2010, in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake that decimated Haiti. Now, after the November vote, the election became deadlocked when none of the candidates received the required 50% of the vote. Now, according to the Haitian Election Commission, the candidates who received the two highest November vote totals were Mirlande Maginot, a former Haitian first lady, and Jude Celestine. The candidate backed Jude Celestine was the candidate backed by the then outgoing president, René Préval. So that name, René Préval, is going to get very important, but he was the president at the time of the earthquake. So the two candidates, Maginot and Celestine, were scheduled to compete in a final runoff election on March 28th, 2011. So this is like a five-month gap between the first vote and the final runoff election, which seems like it's probably not the greatest idea for a country to have that big of a gap in between, an inconclusive election and the deciding election. But that's just my editorializing. But despite the Haitian Election Commission's findings, so the Haitian Election Commission ran the first election and found, the two front runners to be Maginot and Celestine. Despite that finding, Hillary Clinton and the OAS conducted their own audit of the November vote totals. And surprise, surprise, this audit found that popular Haitian singer Michael Sweet Mickey Martelli had actually placed second and not Celestine. So, you know, the domestic Haitian election commissions of their own government finds that there's two front runners, Celestine and Maginot. Then Clinton and the OAS comes in and finds this popular singer to be actually the second place contender. So incidentally, Martelly was the preferred candidate of the OAS. So to assure the Haitian people did not make the wrong choice in who they elected president, Hillary Clinton met with then outgoing president René Préval on January 30th, 2011. Now, remember, this is about two months before the final runoff election was to take place. In this meeting, Clinton muscled Préval into breaking the electoral stalemate between the two front-running candidates. And remember, the two front-running candidates legitimately were Maginot and Celestine. So we read again from that article in Common Dreams by the law professor who was the OAS insider. He says, quote, towards the end of the meeting, she asked Préval to make a last gesture in favor of harmony and understanding. It was to be a gesture that would lead him once and for all to a special place in the pantheon of Haiti's history and the struggle for democracy in the continent. Préval replied with an emotive, albeit enigmatic, smile. It was only him who knew that the crisis had reached its epilogue at that moment. So Hillary Clinton is, you know, leading him along, kind of like putting praise on him and giving him this one opportunity. And he knows at that moment that the election stalemate is going to be broken because of her pressure. Now, as she was leaving the house, Hillary invited Bellerive to accompany her. Bellerive was the then prime minister of Préval. The then prime minister, Bellerive, sorry for my pronunciation, asked Préval for authorization to accompany Hillary Clinton and placed himself between the two women inside the armored truck that left in a convoy to the airport. Confident that she had obtained what she wanted, Hillary Clinton was concerned now with the result of the second round of elections. Bellerive removed all traces of apprehension when he informed her that Michel Martelly was going to win easily, and so he did. Now, as she was heading toward the plane, Hillary Clinton made a comment to Bellerive about his family relationship with Martelly. He confirmed that they were distant cousins. Now, since they were both educated individuals and the game was already over, the Secretary of State allowed herself to make a joke and asked, "You are relatives, but you don't sing." Bellerive replied humorously, "No, and neither does he." Now, Hillary confessed having heard Martelly sing some songs and could not agree more with Bellerive, but then smiling, she left Haiti. So there was some understanding between Hillary Clinton and Préval and the prime minister that Michel Martelly was going to win the election, the second round of elections, that he was going to get through the first round and to win the second round. And this little joke about "you are relatives, but you don't sing," I think Hillary Clinton is like gangster threatening this prime minister, saying like, "You don't talk, do you? You're not going to squeal about this, are you?" And Bellerive replied, "No, and neither does my cousin." So, of course, the prime minister is related to Michel Martelly. He says, "I'm not going to say anything," and Martelly is not going to say anything either. So Martelly proved to be a heavy-handed leader who was subservient to international interests. So to back up this claim, I have another article from Common Dreams entitled "Echoes of Duleve in Martelly's Haiti." Critics of new president imprisoned as Haiti's poor speak out against the government. So it just kind of documents Martelly's history of, you know, imprisoning people who speak out against his regime. And I have another story here about Martelly revoking the status of all the mayors, a lot of the mayors around Haiti, and installing kind of stooges that would do his bidding. So this is HaitianTruth.org. Hang on a sec there, everybody. Welcome to the portion of the show where I tell you how you can help support this content. So I am doing a new Rakuten affiliate program. If you want to check this out, it'll be at libertyweekly.net/support, but also at /cashback. You can become a member of Rakuten. You'll get $30 in PayPal monies if you spend $30 and you use my link. You can go to all these different websites, including eBay, and you will get cash back up to 10%. sometimes more than 10% cash back on purchases that you make. And if you use my link going through again, either /support or /cashback, then you will get $30, and you'll also be helping out the podcast at no additional cost to you. It's a free program. And as well, if you go to /support, you'll see all the ways that you can support this show. Give me a rating and review on iTunes or Google Play. I'll read it on air. Also, like, share, comment, subscribe, rate, review, all those different things. Interacting with this content really helps the algorithms, and I really do appreciate it. It helps get the word out. I also write on Substack. I write columns. This is a column I wrote, obviously, on the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org/Patrick. If you'd like to support me monetarily, I do have an Amazon wish list where you can go and see books and equipment that I'd like to have for this show. So if you do libertyweekly.net/wishlist, that will get you there as well. You can subscribe with cryptocurrency for monthly Patreon bonuses, for a crypto discount through float.app. So check out my link there. Also, there's a PayPal button. You can become a patron or a subscribe star supporter for these bonuses. I do early access. I also have meetings with patrons where we do a Zoom party together, and we chat and hang out, and that's a lot of fun. So I also do, early access and access to bonuses and extras. This article was actually pre-published on Patreon a few days ago. So I also have these crypto addresses where you can support in order of preference. And I also wanted to remind everyone that I am accepting submissions for publication to libertyweekly.net. I'm looking for a dedicated staff of writers who would be willing to put out articles maybe once every 2 weeks. So if you're interested in that, I'm looking for hardcore libertarian theory. I'm also looking for JDs, lawyers who will be able to write actual legal content. I'm also looking for people who would be able to write hardcore libertarian theory and maybe a smattering of foreign policy. So if you'd like to have your voice heard, please submit your articles to me at patrick.mcfarlane@libertyweekly.net. I'm looking to get this up and running by next month. Thanks. Without further ado, back to the show. So Martelli was a stooge subservient to international interests. And during his presidency, we know this because during his presidency, NGOs and the U.S. State Department poured $12.9 billion into Haiti. Ironically, under the slogan Building Back Better. I'm not kidding. That is the slogan that they used. One central planner in the U.S. State Department's Haiti task force called the program a petri dish for technocratic central planning. So to document this, we have a very, of course, widely circulated story in the Rolling Stone from August 4th, 2011. And it documents the relief efforts that plagued Haiti and how all that turned out. It starts with some story about Sean Penn and his efforts that didn't work. And, saying, well, he meant well. So we go down and it documents how the Clinton Foundation and all of the U.S. State Department, how the plan came for Haiti, how they took all of the money. So this May, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported that the $1.14 billion allocated by Congress for Haiti last year, of that, only $184 million has been obligated. In a letter to the Obama administration this spring, 53 Democratic members of Congress blasted the appalling conditions in the refugee camps. Quote, the unprecedented relief effort has given way to a sluggish at best reconstruction effort, said Rep. Barbara Lee, who is demanding an accounting of how the relief money is being spent. There is, she said, quote, a lack of urgency on the part of the international community. So as the relief effort is dragged on for well over a year, virtually every actor involved has blamed the others. U.S. aid officials pitted against Washington bureaucrats, U.N. agencies against private aid groups. Some veteran insiders blame a new breed of technocrats who, with little to no experience in development, have descended on Port-au-Prince armed with bold theories and PowerPoint presentations, as if the entire country were a case study from Harvard Business School. Others say the goals were too lofty, the plans unrealistic. Maybe Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, was simply too damaged to be fixed. Or perhaps the very idea of fixing Haiti is at all a flawed concept. Imagine that. revealing not only the limits of Western humanitarianism, but the folly of believing that any country and its problems are ours to set right. So amid all the finger-pointing, however, nearly everyone taking part in the relief effort is quick to place at least some of the blame on the Haitians themselves, those bastards. Corrupt is the reason those reconstruction funds haven't broken loose, says one U.S. business consultant who describes most Haitian politicians as pathological narcissists with little interest in helping their own country. Such accusations have been made by outsiders for as long as outsiders have tried to help Haiti, which itself may be the biggest problem, huh? So Haitian people have always found a way to get rid of those who have tried to control them, says Raoul Pack, Haiti's former minister of culture. It's very easy to point at the Haitians for being corrupt or weak. What's much harder is looking at what's wrong with those who say they are just trying to help. And of course, you know, you breed corruption by throwing out money to whoever will reach up and grab it. So this is a long, long feature in the Rolling Stone documenting all of this. I mean, you can see on the screen. So I would encourage everyone to check out that story, as I'm sure there's some obfuscation of the truth hidden by Rolling Stone in this article. But you know, that's why my program exists, trying to get to the bottom of it. So despite all of this foreign investment, Haiti remained and remains in an appalling state of ruin, raising questions of how exactly that money was spent, to put it lightly, frankly. In 2015, Martelly's term expired and elections were again delayed. Noticing a pattern here? Eventually, Moise, Martelly's handpicked successor, won the presidency. And we're going to have to follow that up with a link. So this is another one to the NACLA. And we go to handpicked successor. And so this is where I got this quote here. This is my source for that assertion, that he was the handpicked assessor. However, they back it up with a link saying that the election was fraudulent. This is a report from the National Lawyers Guild, the Haiti section, and you know, other public interest groups who have produced a long report claiming that Moise's election was itself fraudulent. And we'll get into that right now. So several observers have deemed this election, Moise's election, provably fraudulent, pointing to undue influence from EU and OAS observers. The fraud allegations became so prevalent that the Haitian Electoral Commission formally called for the election's annulment. Nevertheless, the U.S. and OAS support, the United States and the OAS supported the results, leading directly to Moise's presidency. So here we see this is a report of the commission, an independent commission report to evaluate the verification of the election. This is in French here, so that's why I'm kind of struggling. But you see, I just linked to that whole report. So under the platform Haiti is Open for Business, among other efforts, the presidencies of Martelly and Moise propped the door open for foreign states and NGOs to pillage Haiti. Furthermore, the presidents also demonstrated a willingness to cooperate with OAS's meddlesome plans for other Central and South American nations. So if we follow that link, I use this story a lot, this NACLA story, but there's something in here about Argentina. And, well, at least other South American countries, and how Martelly and Moise kind of went along with the OAS's plans for those countries. And actually, it's not Argentina, it is Venezuela. So here we have Moise met with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago in March 2019. Haiti was crucial in the U.S.-led effort in the OAS to not recognize Nicolas Maduro as the legitimate president of Venezuela. Despite the billions of aid Haiti received from Venezuela through Petrocaribe and bilateral cooperation that began in 1815 when Haitian President Alexandre Petion proved crucial arms and support for Simon Bolivar, President Moise sided with Trump. So despite all that history that Haiti had with Venezuela, and Moise sided with Trump on that issue. So I just use that to try to assert basically that Moise himself is involved with the U.S. State Department, and that there is collusion there at the very least. And of course, it's circumstantial evidence, but that is evidence of it's a direct situation in which Moise went along with the United States plans and was instrumental in, you know, our other nation, empire, you know, other acts of the empire around the world, specifically with Venezuela, which the United States considers somewhat of a rogue regime. And we've been implicated in regime change operations there before. So it would stand to reason that, you know, it's more likely that that link is more likely that Moise at least colludes or is friendly with the U.S. State Department if he was willing to support them on such a critical mission. So here we have the next section of my article. The U.S. has an extensive record of intervention in Haiti. Indeed, U.S. intervention in Haiti is nothing new. Most notably, the last time a Haitian president was assassinated, the U.S. invaded that country and occupied it for the next 19 years. So in case you didn't know, Haiti was invaded and occupied by the United States in the early 1900s. So we have here the official office of the historian, the U.S. State Department history, the U.S. invasion and occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934. So following the assassination of the Haitian president in July of 1915, President Woodrow Wilson, one of history's greatest villains, one of the United States' greatest villains, sent the U.S. Marines into Haiti to restore order and maintain political and economic stability of the Caribbean. Obviously, that worked very well. This occupation continued until 1934. So the U.S. Government's interests in Haiti existed for decades prior to its occupation. As a potential naval base for the U.S., Haiti's stability concerned U.S. diplomatic and defense officials who feared Haitian instability might result in foreign rule of Haiti. In 1868, President Andrew Johnson suggested the annexation of the island of Hispaniola, consisting of Haiti and the Dominican Republic, to secure a U.S. defensive and economic stake in the West Indies. Excuse me, from 1889 to 1891, Secretary of State James Blaine unsuccessfully sought a lease of Mole Saint-Nicolas, a city on Haiti's northernmost coast, strategically located for a naval base. In 1910, Taft granted Haiti a large loan in hopes that they could pay off their international debt, thus lessening foreign influence. The attempt failed due to the enormity of the debt and the internal instability of the country, of course, blaming the Haitians themselves. France, as the former colonizer of Haiti, retained strong economic and diplomatic ties with the government. In 1824, Franco-Haitian agreement, France agreed to recognize Haitian independence if Haiti paid a large indemnity. This kept Haiti in a constant state of debt and placed France in a position of power over Haiti's trade and finances. So as a result of increased instability in Haiti in the years before 1915, the U.S. heightened its activity to deter foreign influence. Between 1911 and 1915, seven presidents were assassinated or overthrown in Haiti, increasing U.S. policymakers' fear of foreign intervention. In 1914, the Wilson administration sent U.S. Marines into Haiti. They removed $500,000 from the Haitian National Bank in December of 1914 for safekeeping in New York, safekeeping, thus giving the U.S. control of the bank. In 1915, Haitian President Jean Vilbrun Guillaume Sam was assassinated, and the situation in Haiti quickly became unstable. In response, President Wilson sent the U.S. Marines to Haiti to prevent anarchy. In actuality, the act protected U.S. assets in the area and prevented a possible German invasion. The invasion ended with the Haitian-American Treaty of 1915. The articles of this agreement created the Haitian Gendarmerie, essentially a military force made up of U.S. citizens and Haitians and controlled by the U.S. Marines. The U.S. gained complete control over Haitian finances and the right to intervene in Haiti whenever the U.S. government deemed necessary. Seems like that agreement still goes to this day. The U.S. government also forced the election of a new pro-American president, Philippe Sondré, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that, by the Haitian legislature in August 1915. The selection of a president that did not represent the choice of the Haitian populace increased unrest in Haiti. So, so we see, you know, blatant, the State Department is acknowledging blatant carte blanche manipulation of Haitian politics. And it's pretty blatant there that we've been involved in Haiti. And, you know, no wonder the country is just can't catch a break. It's, yeah. So let's see here. So the extended record of U.S. meddling in Haiti is voluminous. And I cite here Ted Snyder's article from antiwar.com. This is even going past the Haitian occupation, or the U.S. occupation in 1915 to 1934. He writes, America and its allies have a long history of coups and interference that have caused Haiti to struggle to attain stability. Haiti's democratic wishes have long been snuffed out by the U.S., and the people of Haiti have never had much say in whom they want to lead their country. In 1959, when a small group of Haitians tried to overthrow the savage U.S.-backed dictator Papa Doc Doulavet, the U.S. military, which was in Haiti to train Doulavet's brutal forces, not only helped locate the rebels, but took part in the fighting that squashed them. A quarter of a century later, when the people of Haiti longed to elect Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power, the CIA, with the authorization of President Reagan, funded candidates to oppose him, according to William Bloom in Killing Hope. When the people of Haiti surmounted American obstructions and elected Aristide, the U.S., sometimes with the help of Canada and France, took him out twice. CIA expert John Prado says that the chief thug amongst the groups of thugs in militia behind the coup was a CIA asset. Tim Weiner, the author of Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, agrees. Weiner says that several of the leaders of the junta that took out Aristide, quote, had been on the CIA's payroll for years. So that's Ted Snyder at antiwar.com. Next section of the article, more foreign intervention will not fix the errors of past intervention. So after the assassination, it took 13 hours for the editorial board of the Washington Post to clamor for the U.S., other foreign states, and international NGOs to swoop in, quote, with swift and muscular intervention. Others like Colombian President Iván Duque have also urged for military intervention. So this is the reason why I wrote this article. And we see here, here's the op-ed by the Washington Post. Opinion, Haiti needs swift and muscular international intervention. This is an opinion made by the quote-unquote editorial board, knowing that the Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, and Jeff Bezos, one of his largest contracts is to provide services for the CIA. So the pre-dawn, actually, I'm not going to read this, but this is the article, and I address, you know, the points that they make. And I wanted to focus in on, too, the fact that Colombian President Iván Duque has urged for military intervention, also because of the fact that it's well known that Colombia especially has a special relationship with the United States, that the United States military trains and funds the Colombian military. And in fact, I get into this too, but many of the members of the assassination squad of President Moise were Colombian vets, like Colombian military vets who received direct training from the United States. So despite the fact that Moise's presidency itself was due in large part to U.S. meddling, I documented that above in the OAS involvement in the election that elected Moise, and you know, the fact that Moise was Martelly's handpicked successor and that Hillary Clinton put Martelly in position. So that's the point I'm making there. But the Washington Post laments Moise's poor track record, despite the fact that the State Department installed him, using it to support its case for more intervention. So they're saying, oh, Moise is such a bad guy. Even though we installed him, we're going to use his atrocities to support our case for more U.S. intervention. So the prime directive of said intervention, as advocated by the Washington Post, would be yet another round of elections to produce a government, quote, that would be seen as legitimate in the eyes of most Haitians. And I'm sure that, you know, more intervention by the OAS and the U.S. State Department would certainly, you know, create the illusion. They trick the Haitians again. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So if this new round of elections is anything like the last three, the same international interests will ram through yet another authoritarian lapdog. Now, to achieve these elections, the Washington Post advocates yet another international peacekeeping force occupy Haiti, much like the 2004 to 2017 UN stabilization mission, which the Washington Post cites directly. This is an occupation the Washington Post themselves concede that it introduced a cholera epidemic into Haiti, that there were several credible allegations of rape and sexual abuse by the UN stabilization forces, and that these rapes and these forces, quote, fathered hundreds of babies born to impoverished local women and girls. This is the Washington Post are admitting this in their argument. So you see, the Washington Post argues that the problem is not that nation building does not work. Instead, they argue the problem with the last UN stabilization mission was that it constituted troops from Nepal, Brazil, and Uruguay, and not from other Western leaders like the United States, Canada, and France. Furthermore, the Washington Post argues that the above unintended consequences, you know, like cholera epidemics and mass rape and sexual abuse. Now, to be fair, it's alleged, but however, the Washington Post, for sake of this argument, they take it as fact. And they say, despite all this, it's worth it, kind of like a Madeleine Albright deal, because, quote, the UN force did manage to bring a modicum of stability to the 2004 uprising. So all these terrible things that happened, hey, you know, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. You know, we need to keep a modicum of stability to the 2004 uprising. You know, we'll sacrifice, you know, we don't live in this country. We're just outsiders and foreigners here. But we'll decide for the Haitian people that we'd be willing to sacrifice, you know, a bunch of their young women, and we'll be willing to sacrifice a bunch of their kids and elderly by infecting them with cholera. That'll be worth it to preserve a modicum of stability in that country. So, of course, the Washington Post fails to mention the U.S.'s instrumental role in causing the 2004 uprising to begin with. You know, the one that UN stabilization, the UN stabilization mission, as they call it. So let's investigate this link here. This is a link to The Guardian, this is CNN. CNN reporting in 2004, you can see the vintage website here. In 2004, former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide said Monday he was forced to leave Haiti in a, quote, coup d'etat by the United States. He says, quote, I was told to avoid bloodshed, avoid bloodshed, I'd better leave, he said to an interview on CNN. Earlier, the Bush administration vigorously denied that Aristide was kidnapped by U.S. troops, which is what two U.S. members of Congress said the deposed Haitian president told them in telephone calls. Scott McClellan, press secretary for the White House, says, that's nonsense. I've been seeing some of the reports, and they do nothing to help the Haitians move forward to a better, more prosperous future, which, of course, we need to bring them to. So one day after Aristide left the country and 1 month after a rebellion began in northern Haiti, heavily armed Haitian rebels drove into Port-au-Prince Monday, moving into the headquarters of the National Police, where U.S. Marines took up positions across the street at the presidential palace. That is my link for that. And you could say, oh, well, it came from Aristide himself, who's a bad guy, but there's other sources that corroborate him. And, you know, if we're going to listen to the State Department, we might as well listen to what the other side has to say, because the U.S. State Department, they're biased. They, of course, Aristide is also biased. However, they have a proven track record of lying and overthrowing governments. So again, there is circumstantial evidence of the U.S. involvement in the assassination. Now, given the Washington Post's deep ties to the CIA, which I detail, I link to at least the ties, Jeff Bezos owning the Washington Post, but also receiving some of his largest contracts from the CIA itself. But its editorial board's urgent advocacy for U.S. intervention is suspicious, especially as circumstantial evidence points to some degree of U.S. State Department involvement in the assassination itself. For instance, cables released by WikiLeaks have linked Prime Minister Claude Joseph with the National Endowment for Democracy, which is the U.S. State Department's engine for regime change operations across the world. excuse me. Furthermore, the U.S. military has a long history of training and arming the Colombian military, whose veterans compose the majority of the assassination squad. At least one prominent member of the team, Manuel Antonio Grosso Guarin, received direct training from the United States military. So to a link here, I have El Tiempo, which is a Spanish speaking website. I believe it's Colombian, but if you go through and do Google Translate, let's see here, translate this page, you'll see Manuel Antonio Grosso Guarin was until 2019 one of the best prepared military personnel in the Colombian Army. He received special command training with American instructors, and in 2013 he was assigned to the Urban Counterterrorism Special Forces Group. But of course, the U.S. State Department has vehemently denied involvement in the assassination. However, suspicions of U.S. involvement aside, it is admittedly infinitely plausible that a very unpopular president in Moise was assassinated by purely domestic opposition. So the U.S. and U.N. intervention, this is the final section. U.S. and U.N. intervention is not warranted even if Haitian officials request it. So on Saturday, Interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph asked the U.S. and U.N. to, quote, deploy troops to protect key infrastructure to aid the country as it prepares for elections. Matthias Pierre, Haiti's elections minister, expressed support for Joseph's request. Now on Saturday, quote, a senior Biden administration official said the U.S. has no plans to provide military assistance at this time. However, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki also noted that agents from the U.S. Domestic Federal Bureau of Investigation and Department of Homeland Security would be dispatched to Port-au-Prince, quote, as soon as possible. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and President Biden have both reportedly promised to help Haiti. So the door is not shut on this. And that's a big reason for my episode and why I would ask everyone to spread it far and wide. So, and I wanted to note here that we are sending domestic FBI men, G-men, and Department DHS agents to Haiti, a foreign country. I just thought that was of note. So even if Haitian officials ask for assistance, the U.S. and U.N. should not provide it. If a U.S. business, imagine this, if a U.S. business magnate had orchestrated an assassination of the U.S. president and the vice president requested foreign soldiers to secure key infrastructure across the United States, Americans would likely see these foreigners as an occupying army. In fact, we'd probably go out with our guns and start a war against them. So in fact, foreign occupation was a large reason the U.S. colonists fought their war for independence in the first place, 1776. Many American officials at that time had also asked for British occupation. So, you know, you have a bunch of Tories and loyalists in the colonies. Of course, you know, a large majority of the population invited British soldiers to come to the New World. So some Haitians are equally tired of foreign intervention in their domestic affairs. Journalist Kim Ives, who we heard from at the beginning of this episode, he's the editor of the English section of the newspaper Haiti Liberté, told Dan Cohen of Behind the Headlines, quote, essentially, we have a U.S. puppet in Claude Joseph asking his puppeteer to invade Haiti for the fourth time in just over a century. But in both the region and above all, the Haitian people are sick and tired of U.S. military interventions, which are largely responsible for the nation's current debilitated critical state, both economically and politically. Much of the most oppressed neighborhoods are now heavily armed and have already announced a revolution similar to that which emerged against the U.S. Marines in 1915 and U.N., quote, peacekeepers in 2004, but only it would be more ferocious. So regardless of the outcome of the latest interventionist snafu in Haiti, these are my words, and regardless of how bad the situation becomes, foreign intervention will not solve the myriad problems caused by foreign intervention. After over a century of ill-fated international involvement in Haiti, it's high time for a radical concept. Imagine this. Haiti should be left for Haitians to govern themselves. Anyways, I really do appreciate that. Check out my documentary, Stain of the Century, an investigation of Uyghur genocide allegations. Thanks again if you are coming from Free Man Beyond the Wall, Pete Quinones podcast. I really do appreciate that. And I hope that you stick around, and I hope that you enjoyed this content. Peace.